German car giants shake off their Nazi past to prepare for war. That was a title in The Telegraph this weekend, and it points back to a critical warning that Herbert W. Armstrong gave even in the dying days of World War II. We're going to take a look at that and more on today's Trumpet World. More and more German manufacturing companies are looking at getting back into the arms business. In many ways, it seems like the perfect solution. Car sales are struggling. Companies like Volkswagen are desperately trying to stop having to close factories in Germany, something that in many cases they've not had to do in their history. Meanwhile, Germany is going on a rearming spree. So can they take their car factories and start making weapons? A growing number of German businesses are doing this, and even more are talking about doing this. I'm joined today by Joshua Michels to discuss this absolutely critical trend. Joshua, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me again.
So what companies have we seen so far make changes to move into the arms business?
So quite a few of the German companies, they have dual use. For example, Rheinmetall is the biggest arms manufacturer, but they also had automobiles a sector where they were producing car parts and things like that. So they were one of the first ones to switch because they said, right now we have more production in the arms sector, so let's switch directly to producing more arms in our civilian part of the company. So that was an obvious switch for them. There are other companies that have been producing, for example, parts for trains, and they have been bought by another arms manufacturer, KNDS, which is like a joint venture between Germany and France.
Or KNDS, so in English, I guess.
KNDS.
For our English listeners.
Like that. KNDS, yeah, they're German and French combined, but you can say the English version. And then we have also people that have been laid off, for example, in the civilian sector, and the German company Hensoldt, which produces radar system, also used in Ukraine on the battlefront. They said, we are taking on those laborers and they are now going to work for us. And then, as you said, there are other companies that look into this option more, like Volkswagen. Volkswagen, they are over multiple manufacturers. They have, for example, the truck manufacturer MAN, and they have been cooperating with Rheinmetall for quite a few years already in producing military trucks. But right now they are looking at their car manufacturing plants and say, well, we're not really using them right now. Then the Rheinmetall CEO came in and looked, can they be used for producing tanks in the future? So these have been some of the latest developments.
And I feel like this is a story that keeps popping up week after week on Trumpet World, where we devote like 2 minutes to the latest news of what has happened on it in the last week. I think we've had Italian manufacturers that currently make car parts that feed into the German auto industry that are struggling, saying, well, can we make parts instead to feed into the German defense industry? I think we talked even just on the Wednesday show very briefly about Porsche, that own a lot of a major stake in VW, in Volkswagen, that are, or maybe it's the other way around, they're, whatever it is, their corporate structure, they're linked to Volkswagen. They've been talking openly about getting more involved in the German arms industry. So we've been covering this as the story drips. But you put this together and there is a very major trend here as European companies look to pivot. And perhaps we could even see this only turbocharged by the tariffs that are gaining. You know, that's the major news story as we talk right now. How is this going to affect the world? I mean, this could be one quite tangible effect. If German car companies, they sell a lot to the United States, they're going to sell a lot less if their cars suddenly become 25% more expensive. And if you get subsidies or you can write off loans on American cars against your taxes, but you can't do that to European cars, you're looking at quite a major hit. So this we could see taking on even more of a role in the future. But one thing that this Telegraph article does quite well, and one thing that we've done very consistently at the Trumpet you know, long before this Telegraph article about German car giants shaking off their Nazi past came out, is to point back to their Nazi past. And for a lot of these companies, okay, they're saying we're going to pivot from car manufacturing to weapons manufacturing. Really, this is a return to their roots for so many of these companies.
Yes, and shaking off the Nazi past almost implies that they're getting rid of that Nazi past and that they're now like clean of it and they're not burdened by that Nazi past anymore. No, they can act freely. But as you said, it's more like them going back to the roots, bringing that past back up and doing what they have always done. Volkswagen is a prime example for that. Volkswagen is as close as you can get to a company that was founded by Adolf Hitler. It was his idea to get every German a car, or at least that's what he said he wanted to do, because none of those Germans actually got that car that they were promised to get, because as soon as the war started in 1939, that plant that he was there when he inaugurated it started producing weaponry. So from the very beginning, Volkswagen was not a people's car. It was a car that brought people to the front into warfare. It was not for leisure, as they were promised. And lots of German people actually bought into it. They paid for their car and never got it. And still that same company today is not apologetic about that history.
And Porsche is another one of these companies. You know, even Mr. Porsche, the guy that ran the company, was, I mean, you could kind of call him Hitler's Elon Musk, maybe. That's not meant as an accusation against Elon Musk, but he was an industrialist, you know, wealthy industrialist who worked with Adolf Hitler and helped get high-tech projects done.
Yes, the Telegraph article quoted the author of this book here, David de Jong. He's a Dutch journalist, and he has looked into the Nazi billionaires, as he calls them, people that are today billionaires, but they received their riches and wealth during the time of Adolf Hitler. And Porsche is one of them that he highlights, and others have been highlighting them too, but he has been digging a little deeper into showing all those links that Porsche was involved. And as you said, he was a designer of the Porsche car, and it was a sports car, and he was actually working together with a Jewish man that was racing those cars, but he was also part of the company. Now then, working with Hitler, he got rid of that Jewish partner of his, gave him very little for it, ended basically the friendship and cooperation they had. Hitler gave him a huge plot of land to build a company, which was taken away from Jews, so it was Aryanization, as they said, and the company then from their crew and bigger and bigger and bigger. And the really military, the spike came with the military when they start producing arms. That's when the company started to really get rich. And they had to increase the labor force. And how did they do that? They used concentration camp laborers, Jewish people, but also from the Eastern Front, Russians, Polish people, slave laborers. They were brought in there and they worked basically till they died in many cases. One of the Spiegel articles from 2020 cites that 350 babies were killed in that plant, essentially, because they were taken away from their mothers that they could work in the plant. And so Porsche put his son-in-law over that plant. This was Piëch, and he joined early on the SS. So he was ideologically connected to Hitler. So there are multiple connections. So some are saying like, well, he just saw it was more profitable to work with Adolf Hitler. There was no option. But I would be careful to say things like that, because after World War II, these men, the Porsche family and those who married into him, they have not really apologized for it. They just said, we saw the business opportunity. And they even left out the history where they got rid of their Jewish co-workers, and they did not talk about the Aryanization. In some cases, they even denied it. So to just say that they were just in for the money is a dangerous assumption.
You know, you mentioned you've read the book that this article quoted from, which is, you know, why I wanted to get some of your thoughts on this. This is a bit of an aside, but one thing that piqued my interest, it mentioned Porsche not just working on, like, say, the commission that designed Germany's Panzer tanks and the Tiger I tank and things like that, but also, I think, the V1 and V2 rockets. I mean, do you happen to know, did the book talk about that in more detail? The Telegraph didn't have much to say, but I was very curious about how Porsche was involved in that.
It has been a while since I read the book, but I have been reading some recent articles. So basically, you have those big manufacturing plants, and then you start producing plans for other things as the need comes around. So the V rockets, they basically was just a short time where they were producing parts for them. In the book, it says production of weapons and military vehicles had taken off there since spring 1940, when the massive complex was finally completed. Bucket cars, the V1 flying bomb, anti-tank mines, bazookas, parts for tanks, the twin-engine bomber, Ju-88, and the world's first jet fighter, the ME-262, were all being made at a plant to build up the Nazi war machine. So one of the main things they produced were those cars that were able then to be adjusted to be military purpose cars that were then used in Africa, but also on the Eastern Front to transport the troops faster in the Blitzkrieg warfare. So that was the main part. But then there were other plants where they just used whatever the army, the military needed at the time.
So I think a critical thing to understand as we talk about these arms companies returning to their past is to understand that this is exactly what Herbert W. Armstrong said would happen. This is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry picked up on, you know, very quickly, and has been talking about even more specifically for decades, something that it's based directly on Bible prophecy. And really, as you see these companies return to arms manufacturing, you're seeing a fulfillment of Bible prophecy. So, and this was from a broadcast Mr. Armstrong gave in May 9th, 1945. I mean, this is during the foundational conference of the United Nations, just hours after World War II ends in Europe. And I wish we had a recording of it to play you, but we don't from that long ago, but we do have the text where he said, "We don't understand German thoroughness. From the very start of World War II, they have considered the possibility of losing this second round as they did the first. And they have carefully and methodically planned in such an eventuality the third round, World War III. Hitler has lost. The round of war in Europe is over, and the Nazis have now gone underground. In France and Norway, they learned how effectively an organized underground can hamper occupation and control of a country. Paris was liberated by the French underground and Allied armies. Now a Nazi underground is methodically planned. They plan to come back and to win on the third try." And we have seen so much of that forecast for Mr. Flurry proven true. And this was an underground that wasn't designed to say, you know, start blowing up cars day one after the peace, but as Mr. Armstrong said there, to go away and to come back. And since we've had, say, more documents declassified in the years after Mr. Armstrong died, we've seen more and more of the truth of this. We have seen that only the very senior Nazis, and often only few of them, were prosecuted after the war, that so many got away in the rat lines to Latin America. A whole lot more stayed in place. And they kind of stayed in government and they claimed, oh, I had nothing to do with Nazism. And we have now had investigation after investigation from German government department after German government department showing that that was all a lie. And that these people were massively involved in helping the Holocaust, supporting the Holocaust, supporting the Nazis. And they just continued in their jobs from the World War II on into the post-war era. We found that, you know, the judiciary was thoroughly infiltrated by Nazis. They then gave lots of people kind of a clean bill of health when they absolutely did not have a clean bill of health. So they went underground in this fashion. But in 1996, a document that Mr. Flurry's drawn a whole lot of attention to was published that relates specifically to this story. And that shows that on August 10th, 1944, Nazi representatives and SS representatives met with people from Volkswagen and steel manufacturer Krupp and Rheinmetall and several other of these big German industries. And, well, according to this document, they were told, from now on, also German industry must realize the war cannot be won and that it must take steps in preparation for a post-war commercial campaign. Each industrialist must make contacts and alliances with foreign firms, but this must be done individually without attracting any suspicion. Moreover, the ground would have to be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war. So here they were told the Nazi Party would go underground. We saw these companies, in so many cases, things like Krupp, their executives were initially prosecuted, or very top executive, released from jail, never renounced Nazism. If I remember correctly, he kind of died with Mein Kampf on his bedside table or something like that. And so many of these companies that enabled Nazism really rebuilt Germany and German industry after World War II, and now they're returning to arms.
Yeah, and Porsche is the case in point for all you just said. So they were early on in the 1930s, they started cooperating with Hitler. They enabled Hitler. Hitler enabled them. After the war, they were supposed to be charged with war crimes because they had all those crimes and Nazi associations. So if there was a French prosecutor who got it all started, but then it was found out that he had some communist affiliations, so he was taken out of the way, and the charges against the Porsche family got dropped. 1948 came along, Germans started to take over denazification themselves, and they said, okay, the Porsche family is clean, they can go back to business as usual. But as you said, the 1944 meeting, they had Volkswagen Dürr at the meeting, and Porsche is connected to Volkswagen. They are the one that designed the car, they're the one that owns most of the shares. So based on that history, we know that they knew the Nazi plan, and that declassified document in 1996. I read a book in the 1980s that talked about that document because they had access to the archives in the United States and access to archives in Germany. So it was known. It was known what they were doing in those post-World War years, but the United States chose to not put pressure on those companies, even though they know exactly that they were operating according to plan. And what is the next step in that plan? It is to enable the rise of another German military power. So when we now see those same companies that have not been apologetic for what has happened in World War II, returning to producing arms because of whatever circumstances, we have to realize that this was specifically planned and was for something they have not apologized for. So we should be alarmed by this trend. But you mentioned that some articles, they point out that this is related to the Nazi past, but they do not point to that 1996 declassified document, although this is public knowledge.
And I think another way that you see these companies return to the past and a dangerous indication that they've not learned and moved on the way that they said they have is the way that some of these companies are even returning to use of forced labor, where they're accused of at least using slave labor from China, from the Uyghur part of China, in the manufacture of their province. So this is an article from the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. German economic engine roars thanks to forced labor. I mean, that was exactly what you were describing as happening during World War II. The article states, in the manufacture of their vehicles, VW, Volkswagen, the same company we've been talking about, BMW and Mercedes-Benz use raw materials and components that, according to multiple reports, are mined and produced under conditions of forced labor or slavery in the Xinjiang Autonomous Uyghur region. Now, it's worth making clear, they're not the only companies doing this. There are a lot of US companies that have their hands dirty. I think just as we look back aghast at previous generations for their tolerance of slavery, I think other future generations will look back aghast at us for tolerating and buying products made with slave labor. So they're not the only ones that are guilty here. But when they put out big statements and have, I think it was Siemens that has a whole section of their website saying, well, we completely repudiate this history. We've learned critical lessons. We are going to make sure and guarantee we never do anything like this again. and they are doing this again, and they are using forced labor. I mean, that's just a small tangible evidence that these companies, well, there's some fundamental things about them that haven't changed, and they haven't been, say, very diligent about learning these lessons and moving on.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's one thing to say you're moving on. Of course, it's even worse if you're not even recognizing that history. Like with Porsche, they're not even doing that as much as Siemens did it. But then it's another thing to actually change and to be able to perhaps, like Porsche could have done, help that Jewish friend of theirs that they repelled from Nazi Germany during World War II to help him out after the war. Instead, they try to bury that history. And now there are American companies working closely with China, but we do have to recognize that Germany does have a history where they are using their economic strength for military purposes. And we know of that plan that was declassified. So if you see Germany using slave labor to gain an economic advantage, to be able to rise the economic strength of Germany, we have to recognize that it's all going according to plan. And you alluded earlier to Mr. Armstrong making this prediction just after World War II, because he knew that Revelation 17 talks about the Nazi underground. It talks about the abyss in Revelation 17, talking about a continuation from the decline after World War II to then the rise into another military force. So if you connect history with Bible prophecy, with what Mr. Armstrong said, there's a strong, strong warning that we cannot ignore.
That's right. I mean, you mentioned, I'll just quote from that scripture you alluded to, Revelation 17 and verse 8. It says, "The beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition." And Mr. Flurry, he wrote, "Bottomless pit is not the best translation here. It's referring to a pit that goes on and on, as if no one can ever deal with the problem in that pit. And he goes on to say, "And they that dwell upon the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life and the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is." You know, this is, it goes into the bottomless pit. You could say it goes underground. That's where Mr. Armstrong got even the terminology that he used. But you know, those that dwell upon the earth, those that look upon this wonder, like they see it as gone and then it comes right back up. They view it as having disappeared, just like so much of the world views the Nazi machine as, well, that's ancient history now. It's completely gone. And there are so many signs of it having risen back up from the underground, but they just don't see it. Even the way that this passage continues, it specifically dates this prophecy. I mean, Revelation 7 and verse 10 says, "There are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, the other is not yet come." So, well, we can play a quick clip from Mr. Armstrong, where he himself talked about this.
"Now this government, the Holy Roman Empire, began in 554 under Justinian. The second head of government, represented by this 17th chapter beast or wild animal, was Charlemagne, who ruled at 800 AD. He was the French head of state. He was followed by the third head of state, the German dynasty of Otto the Great. And the fourth head of state was the Habsburg dynasty of Charles the Great. And the fifth head of state was Napoleon. Now, these five heads of state were symbolized by the first five heads of the 17th chapter beast of the book of Revelation. Now, the time in which the Apostle John appears to have seen these events, of course, he was writing back in 90 AD and he was on the Isle of Patmos on the Mediterranean Sea, but he seemed to be seeing things in heaven representing things that would happen on the earth, and about the time of their happening, as his vision saw it, was approximately the years along about 1934 to 1937. John wrote in verse 8, the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation. Notice now the 8th verse of the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation. "The beast that thou sawest was and is not." Now the time, you have to figure the time that he's writing of. This was around about 1934 to 1937, when this beast was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, which is a symbol of a condition of virtual non-existence, and yet there was life there that could come back in a resurrection, and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast, which means a government now, that was and is not, and yet is. Now, let's just continue on these next verses, the ninth. And here is the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth, which was a religious organization. And these are seven kings, or heads of state, as I've said. Five are fallen. Now, I gave you the five, beginning with Justinian and ending with Napoleon. And one is. Now, that one is, that's how I know the date of this thing. The one that was at the time of this vision was Mussolini. Mussolini had gone down and conquered Ethiopia at that time. And he had added it to Eritrea, Italian Somaliland, and Libya, and Italy, and he proclaimed it to be the Holy Roman Empire. He had made a concordat with the Vatican, and he said the Holy Roman Empire was reestablished. Now, not many people knew about it. It didn't even make great big headlines in the newspapers. But it was published, and it did happen, and that was the sixth head that was and was not, and yet it was. Now notice from there, one is, and the other is yet to come. That is yet to come in our time, and you are seeing it beginning over in Europe right now. And it continues, when he cometh, he must continue a short space. It won't last long once it comes into fruition as a kingdom. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, just as I explained a while ago, and is of the seven, going clear back to the ancient Chaldean Empire, and goeth into perdition. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings which have received no kingdom as yet. That means they will be ten kings over ten nations in Europe, and which have received no kingdom as yet, but will receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Now that 1 hour is not an exact state of time, in all probability it just means it's going to be very short-lived. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength to the beast. Their military strength, my friends, that's exactly what it means.
Yeah, this prophecy is frozen in time. It's given at the time where the sixth head is on the scene, because God would send a man through whom he would reveal what Revelation 17 is all about while this sixth head is on the scene. And that sixth head was the Nazis and Adolf Hitler. And God used Mr. Armstrong to reveal this. And so if we want to understand what's coming back from the underground, we need to look back to what God revealed and what God restored through Mr. Armstrong. And that shows us about this beast. And then we can see it and watch it coming back up from the underground exactly the way that Mr. Armstrong talked about.
Yes, to be honest, I never thought it would be that obvious. When Mr. Armstrong warned about it after World War II, Germany was basically demilitarized. They were not allowed to have an army. They were actually not allowed to have arms producers again. The Allies said, we're not allowing Germany to be able to be in the position to throw our world again into a war. That's why we're not allowing those arms manufacturers that enabled this World War, that fueled it till the last death of their soldiers, to not rise again. And it's those same arms producers that have worked hand in hand with Hitler, that we have video footage of them cooperating with Hitler, that we have pictures of them standing next to Hitler to revealing the weapons. These same manufacturers, just a few generations later, with the same company names, they didn't even were ashamed to change those names. They are working again to fuel this newly rising military force. And the media today is looking at these things, where in the lead up to World War II, Germany had to be pretty secretive about their militarization plans. They did things underground. They were not allowed to have such a large army. They were not allowed to produce so many arms. And the world was like very skeptical of anything that Germany did. Now, there were media failures even at that time, but it's far worse today, where today the media is encouraging Germany to militarize. Foreign leaders are encouraging Germany to militarize. as we see those same companies going back into arms. And today, we have another warning works through Mr. J.F. Lewis, just like Mr. Armstrong warned, Mr. J.F. Lewis warning today. But it's even harder today to get people's attention about what's happening. But it's so much more is at stake with the military weaponry of today, with weapons of mass destruction. And we haven't even talked about the chemical companies that fueled Germany's World War II efforts that have now the ability to produce chemical weapons of mass destruction and biological weapons of mass destruction and Germany's nuclear program. All of this together shows that Germany is in the ability to throw our world into a much greater world war, exactly what the Allies tried to prevent after World War II. It's an absolute failure.
That's a really powerful point. I mean, companies like BASF are some of the biggest chemical companies on the planet. And I mean, they've bought a lot of British and American chemical manufacturers. And I mean, yeah, you're right. It's not even all that hidden anymore, yet you just can't get the world to pay attention. And like you say, the stakes are much higher than ever. But another reason why it's even more important than ever to understand this is the seventh head of the Holy Roman Empire. There aren't any more heads of the Holy Roman Empire. That just makes this time so much more dramatic. It's going to make the destruction a whole lot worse. But it means this is the last time that this Holy Roman Empire that has been a plague to the world, but it's been a plague to Germany too, and all of Europe. It's the last time that that's going to rise up. And we're getting right to the time where Jesus Christ is going to return and liberate the whole world from this Holy Roman Empire. And Revelation 17 says that it rises, it's there, they give their strength and power unto the beast, but it's just there for a short time. And so another critical reason to understand this is we are watching events lead right up to the return of Jesus Christ in exactly the way that Mr. Armstrong talked about for decades. So now is the time to understand this. And Mr. Flurry has a great article to get caught up on this subject called Rising from the German Underground. It's from a March 2022 Trumpet print edition. The cover there says The Rise of German Industry. But it's a great lesson here in this article. It goes back and it talks about the role that German industry played prior to World War II, talks about the same 1944 meeting that we've talked about, talks about what Mr. Armstrong said, and the way that these German companies have played a major role, even in steering the German government and German foreign policy in recent years, something that we didn't have time to get into. So we'll put a link to that article in the show notes. Like I said, a great place to go if you want to know more about that. We'll take a quick break, and I want to give a unique perspective from Mr. Armstrong on the trade war and Donald Trump's tariffs. And I think this is a kind of a view from higher up that in the quite frenzied, even angry, emotional debates about the trade war and tariff policy, something that we all need to understand. So we'll take a quick break and we'll get back to that shortly. The world is on the brink of trade war. The big news today is tariffs of 104% going on China, doubling the price of Chinese goods coming into the United States potentially. Analysts fear China could take the nuclear option and sell their U.S. treasuries, pushing the American government towards bankruptcy. Headlines are full of angry debate about the virtues and vices of President Trump's trade policy. But the prospect of trade war isn't new. We've stood on the brink many times before. And Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor-in-chief of the Trumpet's predecessor, The Plain Truth, had a lot to say on the subject of trade war. He met with the major participants in previous bouts of trade conflict, and he offered a simple, clear, Bible-based perspective that we desperately need amid all of this heated debate. In 1971, President Richard Nixon hit Japan with a 10% tariff, and Mr. Armstrong met with the Japanese Prime Minister ahead of that crisis, which went on to become known as the Nixon shock. And he spoke to the Japanese leadership and the whole world about the causes for trade war and its solution. A lot of what he said was based around one plain, simple scripture, one that he referenced in the March 1971 Plain Truth article that he wrote on the subject. James chapter 4 and verse 1 states, "From whence comes war and fightings among you? Come they not hence even of your lusts that war in your members?" This is a biblical truth that applies to trade wars as well as military ones. They come because of lust, greed, the spirit of competition. And in that 1971 article, Mr. Armstrong wrote, "There are two overall broad philosophies as a way of life. The world, I repeat again and again, lives on the get philosophy. The other is the give way of outgoing concern for the good and welfare of others equal to one's own self-concern. It's difficult to make human nature see that the latter is the more practical way that pays off bigger in the end." And there were times where even hard-nosed businessmen leaned towards the give way of life because of that practical payoff. And Mr. Armstrong talks about that in his article. In 1914, Ford Motor Company shocked America by paying its workers $5 for an 8-hour day, compared to the going rate that was more like $3.40 for a 9-hour day. Their switch to a mechanized production line meant that they got more production, a lot more production, out of each worker, and they shared the gains with the workers, and they benefited from a happier, more productive workforce. And Ford's pioneering of this production line was a foundational moment for American manufacturing. But the opposite way of life, the way of getting and taking and selfishness, have been behind the decline in American manufacturing. Mr. Armstrong described the way that too often bosses and business owners, quote, took every selfish advantage, and that brought forth more selfishness from workers in the form of the trade union movement, which confronted genuine abuses and genuine problems, but then also brought in problems and abuses of its own. Whoever has the power uses it for selfish advantage, regardless, usually, of the harm to others, Mr. Armstrong wrote. So unions would fight for the interests of their own members at the expense of the profitability of the companies that they worked for, and even other workers. They'd fight even for maybe the short-term interests of their workers against the long-term interests of their own members, pushing companies into bankruptcy. Strikes forced companies to pay unsustainable wages to union workers. The unions resisted change, keeping workers unproductive, sometimes keeping useless workers around, like workers in a job that was no longer necessary. And that selfishness played a major role in the decline of manufacturing in states like Michigan. And businesses relocated still within America to right-to-work states where trade unions had less power. But this selfishness continues to go both ways. You still had selfishness from business owners as well, showing little loyalty to their workers. All too often, investors prioritized quick gains over long-term profitability. They neglected factory upgrades and improvements that would keep their businesses profitable in the long term and their workers employed in the long term, and instead chose short-term benefits. Pension funds were neglected or mismanaged, leaving companies with crippling overheads to cover the pensions that they promised to their workers. Faced with crumbling infrastructure in American factories, it looked cheaper to build brand new factories abroad and staff them with cheaper foreign workers. And so many businesses shifted production abroad, again, with no loyalty to workers that in some cases had dedicated decades of real service to these companies. And they quickly found themselves abandoned and unemployed. And this decline of American manufacturing, it's the result of selfishness all around, from workers, from business owners, even on the international scene. Each nation works to get for its own and its own people at the expense of others. If you look at during the Cold War, America stood for free market capitalism against communist tyranny. And because of that, America championed free trade. And I think there are some comparisons to Henry Ford and the $5 wage. In what America did there. There were some giving principles that America and the world benefited from. Other countries were able to join in this global free trade system and it helped their people grow richer. And these countries sided with the United States in the Cold War and not the Soviet Union, helping America win the Cold War. And so there was some mutual benefit there. But long before the Cold War was over, nations started taking advantage of America's free trade policy. America allowed foreign goods in freely, but too often it didn't work the other way around. Even American allies put tariffs on goods made in the US, protecting their own workers and their own jobs at the expense of American workers and American jobs. In the 90s, China really turbocharged this, offering businesses massive tax discounts or, in many cases, massive subsidies if they relocate their factories and manufacture in China. They wanted to dominate global manufacturing for their own ends, for their own power. And now President Trump is placing large tariffs on other countries, trying to fix years of American manufacturing decline. But again, it's at the expense of other countries and continuing this spirit of getting and competition. 10 years after the Japan shock of 1971, Mr. Armstrong's Plain Truth magazine produced another article on the causes of trade war, as another outbreak of trade war then threatened the world. It stated, "These new battles over trade are strident in tone with strong emotions, and no wonder. The focus of these battles is simple. It is preserving and protecting scores of thousands of industries and jobs, the only means of livelihood for millions. It is a matter of national survival. Your job or livelihood or that of your families is directly or indirectly at stake." And once again, we see the same strident and even emotional tone in these trade wars. "There is a cause for repeated cycles of these crises in world affairs," this article stated. "Millions will not believe it, but the vast majority of humanity are living the wrong way of life. Wrong patterns of living are causing our terrible economic problems. Trade wars, with their attendant threats of unemployment and political upsets, have a cause." So it's this spirit of get that caused America's manufacturing decline. This spirit of get is behind the trade wars that we're seeing threatening to break out all around the world today. And it's a spirit that has been there to varying degrees since the foundation of the world. It is a spirit that this world is built on. That 1981 Plain Truth article did what Mr. Armstrong did so often and took the cause of all of these problems right the way back to the beginning of the Bible and the first two chapters of the book of Genesis. And here God confronts man with a choice of these two basic ways of life, give and get, in the form of two trees, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God gave man access to the tree of life, representing this way of give, love, and outgoing concern. But Adam and Eve chose to listen to the serpent, the devil, who came with what he thought was a better way, based on getting and selfishness and competition. In his book, Mystery of the Ages, Mr. Armstrong wrote, "When God shut off the tree of life, that act marked the foundation of the world. It was founded on rejection of God, on disobedience to God's laws, which define God's way of life, and the evil, sorrows, pain, and suffering in 6,000 years of human civilization have resulted." And so this spirit of getting and greed and competition between individuals, management, labor, nation, and nation, that's been the result of this. And that 1981 article talks about, yeah, there can be a positive competition. There are ways to compete where the intent and the spirit isn't to take from the other, to hurt the other or rub the other's nose in it. But it's that harmful, selfish competition that this world is built on. And the solution is simple. It's to eat from the other tree. To adopt the other philosophy of life, as Mr. Armstrong put it, to live the give way. And that's the way that really benefits. You see that in this $5 wage example. You can even show mathematically, if nations specialize in what they're good at and trade, the whole planet is better off. Now, for one nation to do that alone in today's evil world, well, that does require wisdom and guidance from God and divine protection. You're blindly, naively just going out and giving to a world that is out to take. Well, that's not going to show love to the citizens of your own country. So in this evil world, it's not as straightforward as saying, well, just lower all tariffs and give. There is more to it than that. To solve trade wars forever, to solve hot wars forever, there is a simple but difficult solution. Our increasing problems point to this vital and simple truth. We need a world built on a new foundation. Not to tweak this world. Now, that's why it's a difficult solution. It's not making just one or two changes. It's a world going in a completely different direction. The way of Get is causing problems on every level. It causes problems in families. It causes suffering and misery in individual lives. The decline of manufacturing, global trade war, is just one symptom of a huge number. And as Mr. Armstrong warned, well, trade wars, they escalate into hot wars because they all come from this same spirit of Get. This spirit of Get is causing us insurmountable problems, problems mankind cannot solve. It's soon going to fail catastrophically. But only then will mankind be finally willing to admit he made the wrong choice and build on that new, different foundation. A world based on the tree of life will see individuals prosper and be happier. Nations prosper and be happier. Nations developing their resources and talents in unique ways to the betterment of all mankind. The simple truth behind these trade wars is that we need to see that we've been eating from the wrong tree, that our entire world is built on a wrong foundation. And only then can we build the world and can we build our individual lives on this new, better foundation. And Mr. Armstrong talks about this much more in his book, Mystery of the Ages. I mean, that gets to the heart and core of the world's problems and what God is doing to solve them. And how all of world events ties into that. This is a book that makes the Bible clear and plain and understandable. And we'd love to send that to you. If you go to our website, thetrumpet.com, you can get that book for free. You can read it online. You can order your own free print copy. And this isn't some kind of promotion, this kind of short-term hook. You know, we'll send you this book, hoping to get something in return down the line. You know, maybe we'll take your credit card details and start charging you in 3 months' time. You know, there's nothing at all like that. That is what we're used to from this world that lives the Get way. But we have donors and members that want to live the Give way and that want to give to the world. And the most precious thing that they can give is this truth. And so we send that out with no strings, with no follow-up, with no kickback, with no getting down the line. And we would love for you to have a copy of that book, Mystery of the Ages. So like I said, you can read it online. You can download a PDF or various different Kindle versions. I think we even have audio versions, an audiobook version that you can download and listen to of most of our booklets. But you can also order your own free print copy that you can study alongside your Bible. It's chock full of scriptures. You know, this is not a man's idea. There is so much in there. Mr. Armstrong makes sure everything in there has a scripture reference. You can go, you can turn to your Bible, you can prove it for yourself from your Bible. So I'd really encourage you to go and look at that and do that. If you go to our website, thetrumpet.com, and click on the literature tab, you should be able to find it. We'll have a link to it in our show notes today. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Joshua Michels for coming in on the first half to talk about German industry and their shift to military development. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. If you have any questions or comments, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you. We'll be back for our regular Week in Review show on Friday. And until then, keep watching your world.